everyone but you. And when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. To a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day. And through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes. My heart.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Hasper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Get the lowdown on the publishing industry. Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She talks to anyone who's anyone in publishing. Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KUCI FM in Irvine.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good evening and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and we're available via podcast, either through iTunes or at Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. Simply click on the radio tower on the top left side of your screen, which will lead you to our radio page. And near the top of that page is a link to archives of our past shows. This interview will join more than 150 others up and available to you now. And if you've got a favorite book, a favorite author that you're looking for and want to hear more about them, you know, odds are you should check it out and see if they're up there. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara, who will be back with you next week. As always, Writers on Writing features conversations with authors, poets, agents, publishers, anyone and everyone having to do with the art and business of writing. And tonight I'm joined by two wonderful women who wrote two incredible novels, both of which will take us to New York. Sheridan Hay is with me now, and coming up in our second half hour, please stay with me because Catherine Weber will be here. Sheridan Hay worked in bookstores and in trade publishing both in her native Australia and in New York. She holds an MFA in writing and literature from Bennington and has lived in New York for 20 years. Her latest novel, The Secret of Lost Things, published by Doubleday, is part literary mystery, part literary history and part coming of age in New York, as well as a lot of other things. It's a wonderful read for us bibliophiles who love nothing more than to poke around the labyrinth aisles of used bookstores for weeks on end, because it's within one of these bookstores that the novel is largely set. But because I always love to hear the author's take on what their work is really about, I'll allow Sheridan to describe The Secret of Lost Things in further detail. So without further introduction, let's welcome her to the show. Sheridan, welcome.
Thank you, Marie. It's lovely to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. I know this is a busy night for you, and I sure appreciate you taking the time. What a great, quirky world you've created, and a great education on some literary history. I have to confess that I made a run to my local used bookstore a couple of times while reading this, because I just had the itch to get out and buy some lost novels. And
so some that was novels. Well, it's a book about books, that's for sure.
It was lovely. Before I get too far ahead of myself, for those listeners who aren't yet familiar with the book, why don't you first tell us a bit about it?
Well, The Secret of Lost Things is, as you mentioned, a coming-of-age story, although, interestingly, I tend not to think of it as that, despite the fact that the protagonist, Rosemary Savage, comes from Tasmania, wet behind the ears, as they say, and very unschooled in the world. What she isn't unschooled in is the world of books, and she has sort of invented herself out of the pages of books, and she is launched into the theater of the world, sort of literally and figuratively, and is trying to find a home for herself in the world. And she begins in New York, of all places, and in a crazy, quirky bookshop called The Arcade, which some people have equated with the Strand bookstore in New York. Mm. And through her adventures in New York and in the Arcade bookshop, a lost novel by Herman Melville, which actually existed, I mean, the novel he actually existed, called The Isle of the Cross, and we know that it existed because of correspondence that he conducted with Nathaniel Hawthorne, but sadly that novel is lost in time, and in a sense so is my novel about a kind of lost time and all sorts of lost things, collectors being people who are trying to collect up things, who are trying to satisfy kind of desire. And in your little introduction, when you were sort of saying, well, you know, what is the book about, really? For me, the book is really about desire and the question of desire and the idea, really, or the concept that desire exists not to be satisfied. It just exists.
Beautiful.
So if there's a secret of lost things, what it is that we wish to regain them, and that they do return in a certain sense, but never necessarily in the way in which we once imagined them.
Yeah. How did the idea for the book originally come to you?
Well, you know, I spent my teenage years and my youth working in bookshops, and I always felt that they were a very welcoming place, a very humane environment, and a place where I felt that was largely free of judgment, mm-hmm. you know. And so there's much has been made in what's been written about the book about how eccentric the characters are, and certainly they are, and they're quite Dickensian in their eccentricities. But at the same time, you know, having worked in bookshops from about 14 or 15, I really feel that they were places where eccentricity was really sort of celebrated, and certainly more than tolerated. So the idea about a bookshop kind of came from autobiographical experience, but at the same time, like the best sort of autobiographical details, it becomes a kind of metaphor for other things. And a bookshop is a kind of a theater, is a kind of an eccentricity in and of itself is is a kind of a disguise or, you know, a role to play. And, you know, these things sort of came together in my mind. You know, I have worked in books really my whole life. And this, so this was a way for me to pay homage, really, to, you know, the way I raised myself, you know, in that sense.
It's funny you used the phrase, and I think you used it in the book as well, theater of the world. And I felt like I had heard that before, but then I realized, well, I guess there are a lot of iterations on it, but one of them, I think Borges had used the phrase Congress of the World.
Yeah,
probably,
and the Universal Library also is Borges's concept.
Right.
I mean, it's something that reappears in classical literature. You know, this idea of, I'm sorry about the traffic, this idea of the place where all things are housed. Of course, it's a phantasm, but it's a wonderful one.
Yeah, it is.
You know, and it tied in for me with wanting to explore this idea of collecting and what it means to collect things. There is this sort of fantasy of that all objects can be owned or possessed, and of course it is like Moby Dick. You know, we all chase a phantom, and this is another version of that kind of that kind of idea.
And
of course, the Universal Library, Borges's Universal Library, with you know, wonderful short story. I'm sort of riffing on that. Borges appears in the novel as, you know, how could he not, in a book about books. But, you know, so does Shakespeare and Auden and Melville, of course. Lots of people are sort of stuffed in there because this is a protagonist whose consciousness has been constructed from what she has read.
Right, right. I'll mention to our readers that I'm talking with Sheridan Hay, author of The Secret of Lost Things. You know, I have to confess my ignorance about the relationship between Melville and Nathaniel Hawthorne. I guess I came to literature a little later in my life, and so maybe I'm lacking some of what might be considered common literary knowledge, but the novel contains, you know, several actual excerpts from correspondence between them. And sort of hints at perhaps something more than just a friendship between them. I haven't done enough exploring on my own, but Melville seemed quite taken with Hawthorne.
Well, I think he was, you know, really deeply enamored of him. I'm not really trying to imply anything particularly homoerotic or anything. Although certain early scholars of Melville have pointed to that, but I don't think it's an especially well-known attachment, because it cooled very quickly. But they were neighbors briefly for not quite 2 years in the Berkshire Mountains, where Melville was trying his hand at farming rather unsuccessfully, and Nathaniel Hawthorne was renting a small red house only a few miles away, and Hawthorne was already quite well known and on the rise as well, and really considered a great literary figure, even, you know, within the I don't think the Scarlet Letter had been published yet, but Melville wrote anonymously, a wonderful essay that just was raving about Nathaniel Hawthorne, and on that basis they met socially and became fast friends. Hawthorne's influence at the time completely changed the nature of Moby Dick, and in the end, the book is dedicated to the genius of Nathaniel Hawthorne. You know, this correspondence ensued, and Melville very much wanted to make, I think, a great deal more out of it than the rather cooler temperament of Hawthorne perhaps could quite accommodate. And not long after that, Hawthorne moved with his family and subsequently became you know, went to Liverpool and was an ambassador and what have you, and they never really, they met briefly once when Melville went to visit him there in Liverpool or on a trip, but, you know, it never really established the friendship. And I think that this was always a mystery to Melville, why this person who he was so taken with, why it, I mean, his nature was so intensely passionate, and I just don't think that Hawthorne really quite knew what to do with him. Mm. And the correspondence that I have in the novel where he's trying to impress this story on him, this idea he has for a novel which he subsequently writes himself, it's very moving to me. You know, this, I don't know if you've ever had anybody who you so wished to be your friend, mm-hmm. because you so admired them. You know, I find it really quite poignant. And also, because the novel is in part about loneliness, really, and a certain kind of grief, Melville became a way for me to, you know, add on to that. I think he was intensely lonely for a kind of a companionship, intellectual companionship, that I don't believe he ever found again in his life, in this brief friendship with Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Mm. Fascinating. That's, yeah, it's fascinating history. I just, I hadn't realized the connection, and the book so beautifully, I think you really did capture his loss and his, you know, I don't know if it's desperation, but his longing.
Well, he's pretty desperate, you know, writing these sort of incredibly sort of vivid, his metaphors, you know, my heart in your breast, you know, and yours in mine. I mean, you know, this, of course, was, in a way, part of, you know, we have to give a nod to the expressions of the time, but even then, I think it was pretty over the top. You know?
Even then, it would make the best of us run away. Oh, great. That's wonderful. So I want to get into the book itself and the specifics of how you constructed it. And perhaps, you know, the best introduction for you is to read to us, and then we can kind of take it from there. And I know, poor woman, you're standing out on a street corner in New York, and I don't know if you brought your book with you, but
I do have my book with me, and I'll just read the opening, a tiny little bit of the first page.
Wonderful. This is Sheridan Hay reading from her latest novel, The Secret of Lost Things, published by Doubleday.
I was born before this story starts, before I dreamed of such a place as the arcade, before I imagined men like Walter Geist existed outside of fables, outside of fairy tales. My time at the arcade would have gone very differently but for him, for his blindness. His condition, his eyes were nearly useless when I met him, and were it not for his condition, I would never have known about Herman Melville's lost book. Walter Geist's blindness is important, but it's my own with regard to him that remains a lasting regret. And it's the reason for this story. If I start with my own beginning, you will understand how I came to the arcade and how it came to mean so much to me. I was born on April 25th, never mind what year precisely. I'm not so young that I care to put my age about, but not so old now that I forget the girl I was. My birth date, however, is significant in another sense. April 25th is Anzac Day, the most important day of commemoration on the Australian calendar. It is the day when Australians pin sprigs of rosemary to their breast to remember those lost to war, to remember that first great loss at Gallipoli, where rosemary grows wild on the beaches. There's rosemary, that's for remembrance, says Ophelia, once she's lost her mind to grief. Pray you, love, remember.
Hmm. So wonderful to hear you read, because I wish I had heard you read before I read it myself, and I would have read it in your voice, because this is beautiful.
Well, of course, this is how she is named. Her name is Rosemary, and this is her task to remember.
Yeah.
And the book is infused with this sense of loss, although I think it ends relatively optimistically, there is this sense that I have about books and the life of working in bookshops that feels in a way elegiac to me, you know, in sort of forever in decline,
mm-hmm.
and melancholic in any sense, in any case, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a tone, I think, that I am trying to weave throughout the book, and the reckoning and the reconciling with the losses one experiences in life.
Right, right. How much of the story did you know when you set out? How many of these characters did you have in your mind, or did they kind of organically grow as you wrote along?
You know, it very much grew organically. I'm a great in Australia. They have there's a bird called a bower bird, and he builds a bower, and then he goes around all day collecting little shiny things. And if you find a bower bird's nest, it's filled with like bottle tops and bits of tin foil and buttons and, you know, crazy little shiny bits of tin cans and stuff.
Uh-huh.
I sort of feel like that's the metaphor for me. I spend a lot of time looking for shiny things, and, I mean, they may be only shiny to me. I take a lot of notes and work in this associative way.
Mm-hmm.
With this character, because this is a book about books, it was very it worked very well to collect allusions to other things and quotes and ideas and fragments of sentences, whether they were from Henry James or from Borges or The Tempest is all the way through the novel, because she comes from an island, the island of Tasmania, and she comes to an island, and she is sort of an aerial figure, and there is this sort of Caliban-like character in Walter Geist, the albino.
Mm-hmm.
So there are all these sort of riffing on things, and that comes from this, from collecting my shiny bits and having them in my nest and looking at them every day and making associations. So it is an odd, that's really the best way that I can describe the way I constructed it. And at certain moments, it's very consciously a construction, and then other times, just in the way that associations trigger other ones.
Mm-hmm.
In other times, it feels very unconscious. And so, you know, I was sort of riffing on The Tempest and you know, kind of really enjoy, and also on Melville's Moby Dick,
mm-hmm.
being a quest story, you know, the search for a home. You know, these are our oldest stories, the quest. And then, you know, when I really did all my research into Melville's lost novel, it just seemed amazing to me that his lost novel was about a woman who was abandoned, not unlike my character's mother was abandoned, you know, with the, she has no father, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what ends up happening is when you follow your interest and you follow your, you know, your themes start developing, something magical happens and other things that are of a like kind become attracted to those same things, because of course you are looking for your analogous moments, you know.
Right, right.
It's a very, it's a wonderful kind of, I mean, I don't know how else to describe it except that it is this sort of magical thing where like starts to attract like.
Yeah.
And you start, you know, you, I have in the novel, she starts sort of feeling like Melville is following her around. I mean, this is what happens. You start seeing your, the things that you're interested in, you start perceiving them everywhere,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so your job is to write it down and collect it to you. And so this is how it was sort of, this is how the narrative was built. But the real breakthrough, I probably had about 200 pages written in omniscient, and the real breakthrough was sitting up one morning after sleeping and saying, oh my God, it has to be written in first person.
Oh wow.
And when that happened, everything changed.
Yeah.
So then I knew who was telling the story.
Oh, amazing. That would have been a much different book in an omniscient point of view.
Yes, very, very different.
Yeah.
Very, very different.
Yeah, because you've got so many characters going on at the same time, all of whom are intriguing, and I think if it was told in an omniscient point of view, all of whom would be competing for their space, probably.
And also, the thing that makes, I feel, the thing that makes the book work and not be pretentious, you know, it's a literary work, and it, and its aspirations are literary, and I think the thing that manages that is that Rosemary is not a pretentious character at all. She's deeply curious and, you know, deeply searching, and is naive, deeply naive. I mean, she's 18 in the story, even though she is telling it in retrospect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that became very important, that it was her freshness that was perceiving these people in this way.
Right, right. We have just a couple of more minutes. I'm talking with Sheridan Hay, author of The Secret of Lost Things. And, you know, we've been talking throughout the interview about how much research, I mean, it does feel like a fair amount of research went into it. How do you know when you've done enough that you're comfortable and when it's time to stop? When it's time to stop and write, and when it's time to keep going?
It's a very good question, Marie. I don't know that there's ever a sort of a borderline. You know, for me, I think I'm writing all the time, and probably more what happens is I have so much more than I can have.
Mm-hmm.
And then other very conscious construction issues come into play, like tension and pacing, and am I, you know, is the reader bored at this point? I mean, I have this whole section on cabinets of curiosities, which has been a fascination of mine.
Mm-hmm.
This phantasm of from the 15th and 16th century, of this idea that you could collect up every anomaly in the world, you know,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And house them all under one roof. So I have a cabinet in there that a very wealthy collector has. But of course, I could go on about that for 30 pages. I think there's probably 3 pages in there, and I would say that I probably wrote 30, 40 pages.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, what comes into play is the form of a novel, which is that you have a responsibility to your reader to not be tedious.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and plot trumps information. You know, otherwise it's just an exercise in self-indulgence, you know?
Right.
You want to know, you want to love your characters, and you want to know what happens to them. And as much as I am in love with arcane information, it's got to go out the window.
Yeah, yeah. That's
because
so sad, I know.
It gets in the way of that, of emotional connection.
Right, so. Right. Oh, Sheridan, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you've got a lot going on tonight, and I sure appreciate you.
It was wonderful to talk to you, Marie.
Out.
I really appreciate it, and thank you so much.
Thank you. What a pleasure.
Good night.
Good night. We're going to take just a short break, and when we come back, Catherine Weber, author of the haunting novel Triangle, will be with me. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. You know, little darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Hi, I'm Attorney Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. How private is your confidential information? Who is watching you on surveillance cameras or listening in on your private phone conversations? Think of all the information you give up each day, from the fast track scans on the morning commute to the credit card purchases at Starbucks to your cell phone tracking, airline ticket, car rental records, and even the logging of PC keystrokes at work. These bits of data are shared with companies and the government to create a detailed dossier of your daily activities. How are your profiles used, and what can you do to protect yourself? We'll answer these questions and more when you listen to Privacy Piracy, Wednesday evenings from 5 to 6 p.m. at KUCI 88.9 FM or www.kuci.org.
Planetary Radio is Public Radio's only weekly series about space exploration. I'm Matt Kaplan, and I hope you'll join me as we explore Mars, look for life in the universe, and fly through the rings of Saturn. We'll talk with the men and women, scientists and dreamers who are guiding us to a future beyond Earth. And don't forget to enter our weekly space trivia contest. That's Planetary Radio, Mondays at 5:30 p.m. right here on KUCI.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at KUCI.org. And as I mentioned earlier, this show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit penonfire.com for more details on that. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett, who will be back with you next week. And I'm joined now by Catherine Weber. Catherine's short fiction, Friend of the Family, debuted in The New Yorker in 1993. Her first novel, Objects in the Mirror, Closer Than They Appear, was published in 1995. She was named by Granta to the controversial list of 50 Best Young American Novelists in 1996. Her second novel, The Music Lesson, was published in 1999 and has since been translated into 11 foreign languages. Her third novel, The Little Women, was published in 2003. All three novels have been named notable books by the New York Times Book Review. Her literary essays have appeared in numerous recent anthologies, and she's under contract for her next novel, Temper, and a memoir, Symptoms of Fiction. She's written book reviews, essays, and columns for several reputable publications, too numerous to name, and she's taught fiction writing at Connecticut College, Yale, and the Paris Writers Workshop. But it's her fourth and latest novel, Triangle, now in paperback by Picador, which is the subject of our discussion this evening. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you on. Perhaps you can just lead us into the terrain of this novel and tell us a bit about the book.
Well, there was this fire. On March 25th, 1911, in a matter of about 15 minutes, a sweatshop fire engulfed the top three floors of a 10-story building just east of Washington Square. The Triangle Waste Company occupied the top three floors. They were employing approximately 500 workers. Most of them were immigrant women, teenage girls, most of whom spoke Yiddish or Italian. And in a matter of minutes, some 150 people were dead. And of those, about 60 jumped to their deaths from the ninth floor. And it was a horrific fire that changed so much for people. It's a landmark moment in labor history, immigrant history, New York City, Lower East Side history, fire and building code history. Some people point to it and call it the birth. That out of those ashes came the sparks of the New Deal.
Mm.
Francis Perkins witnessed this fire. But it's also a very personal story for me, not only as a child of New York City, but because my father's mother worked at the Triangle in 1909, finishing buttonholes, and she wasn't there by the time of the fire, but she could have been, and the women who died that day were women just like her. So I grew up knowing, in effect, that my grandmother didn't die in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire of 1911.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. What became the central question of the novel that captured your interest, sort of the core thing that you needed to answer for yourself through these characters?
Well, what brought it into focus for me is how am I going to write this novel, because I had in mind for years wanting to write about the Triangle Fire in some way.
Mm.
And what brought it into focus was in the beginning of 2001 when Rose Friedman died, and she was just one of the most fantastic human beings who ever lived, and she lived to be 107, and she had survived the fire that day. She was working on the ninth floor because she had the thought to go up to the roof, to go up to the 10th floor and see what the bosses were doing in the offices. They were gone. They had fled up to the roof without bothering to alert the workers on the ninth floor. The fire had broken out on 8, and they had received a phone call. So it was the ninth floor workers who were trapped. The most,
mm-hmm.
But she survived. She followed the bosses out across the roof, down the stairs of the building next door. She survived and lived and lived and lived. She survived the fire for 90 years. When she died, I wondered about what that was like, to be famous all your life for not having died on March 25th, 1911, and to tell your story for 90 years. Mm-hmm. So for me, one place the novel begins is, what is your relationship to that story? What's it like to tell that story and tell that story? And then leaving the late, great Rose Friedman behind, and I want to be very clear, I have not in any way written a novel about Rose Friedman,
mm-hmm.
What would it be like to tell your story and tell your story for 90 years if your story was a lie?
Right.
And that's, for me, the heart of my story as a way of examining the fire, the impact of the fire, the questions of history, and how is history made, and how do we know what we know, and how do we tell our stories, and how do we listen to our stories. And the way we listen to stories, the questions we ask, the questions we don't ask, all of those things can be addressed in this way, in contemplating the relationship to a story over 90 years.
Mm, beautiful. Perhaps the best way into the novel is for you to introduce us to the world by reading to us.
Well, I'd love to begin at the beginning, just to give you a sense of her voice as I imagine it, but her voice and her story. This is the first time she tells the story, and there's a lot of repetition in the novel, which I hope we talk about,
mm-hmm.
the role of repetition in storytelling and in music, and there's a lot of music in the novel. So where the novel begins is with a fictional, and I want to talk about how fictional this is, transcribed recollection of Esther Gottesfeld, who is my character, who survived the fire as Rose Friedman did and lives to be 106 and dies really at the beginning of the novel, just before September 11th, 2001. She dies in early September.
Mm.
But this is the transcribed recollection of Esther Gottesfeld from a ILGWU commemorative booklet called Remembering the Triangle Factory Fire 50 Years Later. So this is published in 1961, at which point she has already told this story for 50 years. And I'm just going to read from the opening to give you a sense of how she tells the story.
Perfect. Okay.
This is what happened. I was working at my machine with only a few minutes left before the end of the day. I remember so clearly, I can still see it, that I had only two right sleeves remaining in my pile. My sister Pauline, she did the left sleeves, and I did the right sleeves, and between us, we could finish sometimes as many as 24 shirtwaists in an hour, 300 shirtwaists on a good day, if the machines didn't break down, and if the thread didn't break too often, and if nobody put a needle through her finger, which happened all the time, and the biggest problem then was you didn't want to bleed on the goods, but you didn't want to stop work, so you took a piece of scrap and you wrapped your finger tight and you kept working. My sister was a little faster than I was, and sometimes her finished pile would be high because she did her sleeve first, and then I would take from her pile to do the right sleeve, but I have to say, my seams were the ones always perfectly straight. And then when I was done, the waist would be finished except for sewing on the buttons and trimming the loose threads. And who did that was the little girls over in the nursery. That's what we called that corner, the nursery. Some of those girls were only 10 or 11 years old, already working and working, poor things, but what other life did they know? Those little girls would sew on the buttons and cut all the loose threads, and then the waist would be ready for pressing. It was payday that day. It was a Saturday, and the pay envelopes had just been handed out. And before that, for a few minutes, there was a break, and my friend Ida Brodsky, she died. She was a wonderful friend to me. She made a cake for a surprise because of my engagement to Sam, because we had said just a few days before we would get married. We didn't even get a ring yet, and people were happy for us. All the girls working together, it was so cheerful, sometimes even with the hard work. I had my pay envelope and my sister's also to keep for her. We each got maybe $6 or $8 or sometimes less, except in a good week, and once we each made $12 for a week's work, but that was an exception. But you could live on that money we made and send some home, too. We thought we were doing well. We were happy enough with what we had, even though the unions told us to get more and told us we shouldn't be so happy. And they were right. But we were never hungry. We were so young and healthy and strong, and it felt like a chance to get ahead. So we didn't mind the long days and the terrible loud noise of the machines and the smell of the oil everywhere. That oil, they had to use it to keep the machines going, but they could have opened those dirty windows for even a breath of fresh air. It wouldn't have made us work slower, and who knows, it might have made us work better. But all the windows were always kept closed tight, and I remember I just took a moment from my machine to tuck the pay packets for both of us into my stocking to be safe like always. I took them both from our boss, Mr. Jacobs, so my sister could keep working for every minute left, and the next day would have been our one day off in the week, so we were looking forward to that. And then there was a big noise behind me while I was still bending down, like nothing I had ever heard, and I thought, what could that be? So loud, like an explosion and something breaking all at once. So I turn around, and my sister next to me, she turned around too, and what did we see? Flames.
Mm. That was Catherine Webber reading from her novel Triangle in paperback now by Picador. I'm particularly fascinated when personal domains blend with public domains so that there's a blur of what we, the public, have rights on and what we don't. And September 11th, obviously, is a huge backdrop to this novel. And it's an example of that, as was the Triangle Fire. There are these personal stories set within the context of a public tragedy. And when do we cross that line of what personal information is owed to us, the public? And I thought this was brought out so well in George's storyline as well. You know, I mean, what's more personal than... perhaps we should talk about George's storyline first. But did you grapple... Was that one of the issues of the novel that you grappled with, of what Esther owed people?
Well, you know, one of the issues I grappled with when I had just begun to write the novel was September 11th.
Yeah.
And how public and how private is that? And so, although I had not set out to write a novel of September 11th, before September 11th, I very soon realized that, of course, I had to write around it and through it, but I elected not to write about it directly,
mm-hmm.
as the best way to write about it, mm-hmm. in fact. Each fire, you know, each of those groups of people making a decision to jump in an instant, jump or burn, and, you know, the ninth floor, the 99th floor, it's the same decision.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very private moment that those people had, and those were real people, and I never forgot that although I was writing a novel about fictional characters, truly, wholly invented, I was putting them into situations that real people lived through, and I always wanted to respect that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard an interview with you, I think you were on NPR, where you were talking about writing in post-September 11th times.
Yes.
And I'm sure I'll misquote you because I don't have the transcript here, but basically you were talking about all writing now is done with this tragedy in the background.
Well, in a sense, the way that it eradicated the present. If you're writing something set in the present, it used to be that the present encompassed decades, and now so many things make the present past. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have someone spending French francs in Paris, well, I guess it's before they went over to the euro. You know, there are, or someone quaintly unable to get in touch because of a flat tire. Well, they must not have a cell phone. You know, there isn't an Iris Murdoch novel, a writer I admire hugely, where if her characters all carried cell phones, I think there would almost be no plot.
Right.
When you think of the ways novels are set in motion by miscommunication and people who can't communicate or, you know, are missing from positions they're supposed to be in, you know, and so in a way, September 11th seemed to loom so large, and now, in some ways, life has normalized in a way that I'm not sure any of us could have anticipated. There was a time period, I think, when almost anyone writing contemporary fiction set in the United States, especially set in New York or with any sort of New York connection, had to make decisions about how to deal with September 11th. Is this novel taking place before September 11th? Then it's not the present. Is it taking place just before September 11th, in which case this is hanging over these characters? Is it taking place after September 11th, in which case what was the experience for these people? How did it affect them? Did it affect them? You know, there's no way, you know, it's there. It's present even in its absence, I think, in most contemporary fiction now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we've metabolized it. The pipeline, you know, the books are coming out the other end of the pipeline now. They've come out. I think, you know, they're still coming. They're going to be coming for decades and decades. I mean, we're still reading Holocaust novels, after all.
Right.
Still reading Civil War novels. That's legitimate,
right.
Too, you know.
Right. But
I think there was a time when it was just very hard to know what to do next, and it paralyzed a lot of people, and it certainly just loomed over every word I was writing for Triangle.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, the parallels were haunting.
Yes, and you know, the first chapter which includes, you know, if I had kept reading, you would get to the fire and her experience of escaping the fire and seeing people jumping. I wrote that before September 11th.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Hmm.
But to read it is to read it in a post-September 11th world, and you bring your experience of what you saw and heard and read about and still think about from that day, you know, to these pages.
Right, right. You mentioned earlier, and I wanted to talk about it too, the effect of telling the story through the transcripts and trial testimony and news stories, and the repetition of Esther's story being told, always with variations on the story. And I thought it was very clever to tell the story through transcripts where the questions were omitted, so we couldn't hear
yes.
the questioner's voice.
But you know what the questions
were. But we know what
you
the questions
are. You know
what
her voice was.
Right.
By the nature of the responses.
Exactly.
I'm interested in artifact. I'm interested in where we get our information and all the ways that information is encoded, whether it's in the newspaper or old letters in a safety deposit box or the information in your DNA mm-hmm. or the narrative in a work of music. And the repetition of the story, repetition, you know, is what makes music make sense to us.
Mm-hmm.
Those echoes, those themes and variations, anyone who has experienced psychoanalysis recognizes the value of repetition and how you have what's familiar and then you have what comes from it that's new and different this time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so for me, the repetition in Esther's story, which comes to the reader in so many different ways, was intended to have that same quality of the echoes of the different movements, say, in a piece of music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was gorgeous. Did you write those together? Did you write her stories at the same time?
No.
Okay.
No, I wrote them. I wrote the novel almost exactly in the order in which you have read it.
Oh, really? Wow.
And one of the things I wanted to do was age her. Her voice changes over time. She has more comfortable English. She's aging herself. So her voice is at its youngest in the trial transcript because it was at the end of the year of the fire, and she's still a teenage girl.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's at her oldest and weariest, you know, when you actually see her on her deathbed, but also in those transcripts of her interviews with the incredibly annoying Ruth Zion.
Poor Ruth Zion. I'm talking with Catherine Weber, author of Triangle on Writers on Writing. I want to talk about Georgia's storyline because I just thought this was such a gorgeous sort of counterpoint storyline that ripples beneath Esther's plot. And we've talked about, already alluded to the fact that there's a lot of music and riffs on music. Maybe you could introduce George to us just by telling us about who he was and how he constructed his music.
George Botkin is a fictional character in my novel who is a very, very inventive composer of music inspired by forms found in nature, whether it's tide tables or labor contractions or the molecular structure of DNA. And he hears music where other people don't. He sees patterns and makes connections where other people don't. So he clearly has a very highly attuned kind of synesthesia. But he's also a very formal, classically organized musician. And one of the this may be the sort of point an author is very interested in, but it has more meaning for the author than it may for most readers. I wanted him to be a composer who depended on very traditional means to create his very, very original music. So he only uses the instruments in an orchestra. He does not use electronic sound or other sounds. And so in the oratorio with which the novel concludes, where a siren is indicated, first of all, it's an evocation of a siren from 1911 because it's a triangle fire oratorio. Yeah. I used a violin tuned a certain way and the human voice. Very mindful that the Ives composition, Central Park in the Dark, which is very early, I think it's only, you know, I don't know what, 1912, 1914, He was revolutionary because he used an actual siren. But I wanted George to be a traditionalist for all of his inventive sort of visionary composing. I wanted him to make his incredibly beautiful music from the instruments in an orchestra. And I should say that George is inspired in a very conceptual way, not in any literal way, by George Gershwin. As this novel is really in some ways an homage to both of my grandmothers, because there was Pauline Kaufman, the buttonhole finishing immigrant off the boat speaking Yiddish, you know, Ellis Island English in my childhood. And then there was my mother's mother, Kay Swift, who composed Broadway show tunes and was George Gershwin's great love interest. And so George Gershwin looms very large in my family history.
Right.
And I was interested in a composer named George, where the public response to his music is to be a little confounded and not know how to respond to it. Is it high? Is it low? If it's serious, then why do we love it so much and why is it so accessible?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that argument. And I wanted this George to have that same kind of effect on the public ear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, George Gershwin today is still played more by pops orchestras than by serious orchestras.
Right, right. Now, did the idea for the music being sort of the counterpoint to Esther's kind of retelling of her story, was that there from the beginning?
It was there from the beginning in my thoughts. And
okay.
I'm interested that you ask that, because I have to say I have certainly visited many book groups. I think Triangle is a nice book to argue about among people.
Mm-hmm.
I have had people ask me, why did you put all this music in this novel about the Triangle Fire? You know, why didn't you write a different novel about music? And to me, that would be like saying, you know, why did you write the odd-numbered pages in this book?
Right.
I always had in mind that the music was the way the story is told, as much as, or almost as much as Esther's story is telling itself and coming to the surface, and that the music would be one of the ways that brings the truth of the truth of the story, you know, ultimately to the surface. Although it is not a mystery, and in some ways her lie, her secret, her 90-year secret is hidden in plain sight, beginning even in the parts I just read to you.
Right. Yeah, I wouldn't say that that the ending was, you know, it wasn't a surprise.
It's not a mystery. It's the ending is the confirmation and the fuller explanation, the final, last, biggest retelling that fills in all of the blanks, or most of them. But it was never meant to be a mystery, you know, in the Agatha Christie sense. But the music was in my mind, that oratorio existed before I wrote a word of this novel.
Mm. And I have to say, unfortunately, we're just about out of time, but I do have to say that your ability to write for the other senses and to bring alive you know, to bring alive the music on the page. I've never read anything like that. It was really stunning.
I thank you. You know, I just made it all up. I mean, I don't read music, actually.
Don't tell people.
I'm a novelist. I can write about beautiful music. That doesn't mean I can write beautiful music.
Yeah. No, it was amazing.
Well, thank you.
You know, most unfortunately, we're out of time, but I would love to hear what kind of advice or wisdom you give your own students that may assist some of our writerly listeners out there.
Well, if you mean to write and you're not writing, then you're not writing. So step one is you actually have to do it. And I have to say that writing requires a lot of sacrifice, and the first sacrifice is that you have to give up not writing. And
which
a lot
is
of people aren't as prepared to give that up as they think they are. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm not one of those write-what-you-know writers at all, but I do think that you need to know what you write.
Mm, beautiful. Yep. I think you're right. Oh, Catherine, thank you so much for taking the time this evening.
Thank you. I've enjoyed talking with you.
I have, too. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Take care. Bye.
That was Catherine Weber, author of Triangle, available in bookstores now and published by Picador. That's all the time we have for this evening. Before I go, as I always do, I'll leave you with a quote, although not, again, not a writerly quote this time, but a line of poetry that I took from Sheridan's novel, actually, that inspired some writerly thinking for me, from the poet Auden. All we are not stares back at what we are. And with that, we can go meditate on that for a while. Barbara DeMarco Barrett will be back with you next week. So until next time, thank you so much for joining me this evening. Good night.